Are you confused about real food and what's healthy and good for the planet? Do you need the facts about local, organic, and sustainable food? Well, get ready to change the way you eat. Get ready for The Appropriate Omnivore with Aaron Zober.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Appropriate Omnivore. I'm your host, Aaron Zober, covering lifestyles in the world of real food. With the Wise Traditions Conference in Kansas coming up in a couple weeks, I continue my speaker series, interviewing those who will be talking at the conference. My guest today is Alex Miller. Alex is a seventh-generation farmer at Licks Skillet Farm in the foothills of Tennessee's Smoky Mountains. He's also the William B. Stokely Chair of Business at the University of Tennessee. And his talk at the conference is The Loss of Local Farms and What You Can Do About It. Alex, welcome to the program.
Aaron, it's a real pleasure to be here. I look forward to the conversation.
Yes, and I appreciate you taking the time out, I imagine, as both a farmer and a professor, and then you got this presentation that you're going to be giving in a couple of weeks, which I'm sure you're preparing for now. You certainly have a lot on your plate.
Well, it's good to stay busy. Keeps you out of trouble.
Yeah, so glad you can add coming on this podcast as part of those things. So first, tell us a little about your background growing up in farming.
My family's been in East Tennessee agriculture for all seven generations that we've been able to track back. So I grew up with farming in my blood. I grew up on the farm adjacent to the farm that my grandfather had bought in 1919. And my father bought the adjoining farm to bring his new wife home to right after World War II. And I grew up on those two farms, farming with my father, my parents, and my aunts and uncles. And then today I'm sort of the old generation on the family farm. The business has been around for a little over 100 years. And the ninth generation of farmers are now living on the farm. And of course, they're very young and they're just getting involved in it. So it's been a lifetime pursuit and a lifestyle and a living for all those years. And it's just central to what our family does.
I love that. I think that's an amazing story. And it's very inspiring that many generations continue to go into it. I think that'll work well with your story about the local farms. Had you always known that farming is what you wanted to go into?
I'm the fish that has yet to discover water. When you just live in that environment, you really don't consider anything else. I always knew that I wanted a career beyond farming, but I always knew that that career would have to allow me to farm and to raise a family on the farm. I'm the oldest male in my particular generation. And so it was just a family expectation that, oh, well, he'll play a central role in the farm. And I never shied away from that. I always enjoyed that responsibility and knew that it would be part of my lifestyle, part of my family's lifestyle, my kids' lifestyle.
And like you had said, you'd wanted a career past the farm as well. So as I explained in the intro, you're a professor at the University of Tennessee. Tell us a little of what that involves.
So I'm a professor in the business school. That's a whole different chapter of my life. I watched my father graduate on the GI Bill when I was 16 years old. I went to his graduation and said, I don't really understand what it is I'm seeing, but it must be important. I just watched my dad go to evening school for 10 years to get to this point. I decided at that point I wanted to be a professor. And I'd grown up in a household where what the parents did was they lived on a farm and they commuted each week into the university. And that's basically the lifestyle that I continue to, just now instead of a student, I'm a professor there. But it's been an integral part of my life and it's my day job. Unlike most farmers in Tennessee and a lot of farmers across the nation, we call ourselves flashlight farmers. We work during the day and we farm at night and on the weekends. And that's been the way that our farm operated for a long time. Fortunately, now I'm getting to work with a whole new generation of farmers who don't see this as a second career. They see farming as their first career. And that's a really exciting part that I'm playing out. Basically, my role in the farm today is I'm a venture capitalist. I provide capital to grow new businesses, new enterprises on our farm. And I find young people who want to lead those enterprises. And I essentially set them up in business as a way to make the farm more sustainable for everybody. We're trying to build a single community around a farm. Our vision is that someday we would have somewhere between 6 and 10 families living on the farm, all supporting one another. And in many ways, getting back to what farming once was. Farming once wasn't just a job. It was a community. Neighbors supported one another. When my grandfather bought the original farm, it was a very poor piece of land. And a neighbor showed up one day and said, you bought this land too late to get any hay cut. So here's a load of hay to help you get through the winter. And we've never forgotten that. That's what community is all about and what farming is supposed to be about. So we're not just interested in running a farm. We're interested in building a community around farming. And that's a really exciting thing for me to be part of and get to lead.
Oh, yes. I would imagine that'd be very exciting. Like you put it, you're the venture capitalist for the farming community, which I think fits well with being the business professor. What other way would you say the two worlds coincide with each other?
Well, in the talk I normally give about saving farms, I get down to the point of saying, well, here's why farms are important to save. Now, what's the problem? And the answer is, it's the economy, stupid. It's that classic answer is that so many problems boil down to the economy. And I think by being a business school professor, I have a particular perspective on the economics and the nature of competition and all those sorts of things that impact farming so heavily. It also drives home the point that farming has to be a business. If it's going to be sustainable or even regenerative, there's got to be cash coming in. One of the biggest inputs and regeneration of farmland is cash. And that means you've got to understand marketing and you've got to understand customers, because ultimately that's where all your cash is going to come from. And we are a very mission-minded family business with very strong values that guide everything we do. But one of those values is no margin, no mission. So understanding the notion of a profit margin is central to my understanding what business is about as a business school professor. And it plays an important part in the way we think about the farm and what it takes to actually run a farm.
So you mentioned at the beginning about the talks you normally do. And of course, major reason that you're here is the talk you'll be giving at the Wise Traditions Conference about the loss of local farms. So how would you describe the current state of local farms?
Threatened, just pure and simple threatened. Let me give you some statistics. Bear with me just for a moment. Our farm, I don't talk about Tennessee because that's where our farm is based and that's experience based. All those generations of farmers that preceded me, we had been too poor to buy any land. In World War I, my grandfather pulled together enough money to buy a worn out hillside farm, terribly eroded. And that's the way we got into farming. But that was in 1919 after World War I. And over the next 100 years, the number of farms in Tennessee went from 280,000 to 116,000. Aaron, if you do the math on that, that works out to one farm lost approximately every 4 hours for 100 years. And so when I say farmland is threatened, that's what I'm talking about. They're just disappearing. We've gone from 280,000 down to about 60,000 now. And if we don't do something consciously to save farms, then a lot of communities that people are being drawn to today, and especially a lot of the people at Rise Traditions Conference, they're very drawn to a rural community because of the farming and the connections with farming and food that it affords. Well, if we don't do something about it, those options are going to disappear from a lot of states like Tennessee, and farming is going to become just another industry that no one will want to be located around. It'll just be a big industrial plant, if you will. And that's not what people think about or want to be associated with. It's a place that they go to for nurturing in the sense of food, but also nurturing in terms of your spirit. Nobody looks out over an industrial farm and feels, at least I don't feel uplifted. When I see cattle in a CAFO and they're standing there in mud and eating feed that I know is not good for them and is not going to be good for the consumers, that's not uplifting to the spirit, and nobody wants to be around that kind of agriculture. So that, to me, is really a critical thing. The land is threatened, and I think people want to do something about it. If customers don't do something about it, our farmland will disappear.
It certainly is not uplifting the whole CAFO factory farm, and even people that don't know about the story really know how it's disturbing. People such as me who live in California, if you ever drive up the I-5 and you can smell just the awful stench of this major factory farm on the way. Even people that don't know about this, they may not know what Weston Price is or anything. They're bothered by it even though they don't know it.
Yeah, they absolutely are. I think it's a good point. In fact, in my talk, I've got a photograph taken from that very highway that you're talking about. And there's a sign that says no stopping, because I don't want anyone to stop and take pictures of it, because it's really a very disheartening picture to look out over. Compare that to the local farms that I know. I don't think I know a single local farm that would ever object to someone coming and visiting and taking pictures, because we're proud of what we do. We don't want to stop people from seeing it. We want to encourage people to see it and to celebrate it and to get all the advantages that come from having those sorts of farms around them. So it's just an entirely different operation, experience, value set, you name it, it's different.
Yes, that's a very important part of local farms, is transparency and being able to do farm visits. And it's something that's encouraged. Michael Pollan encouraged it in The Omnivore's Dilemma. The Weston A. Price Foundation encourages it as its chapter leaders like me who contribute to the resource list. And so we're encouraged to visit the farms and know what they're about. The Weston A. Price Foundation at the Wise Traditions Conference always, after the conference ends, there's the farm tours. So yes, I would say that's a very major part is farms that allow visit, which you're not going to get that with these big ag farms, the CAFOs, the feedlots, factory farming, but you will get that with small local farms. That's an important advantage to bring up.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, one of the things that I'll include in my talk is here are the questions to ask when you visit a farm. Because if you're not a farmer, you might be uncertain of, well, what's a legitimate question to ask and what would be a question to make people uncomfortable. So I've got 8 questions that I think any farmer that's farming the right way should be happy to answer and to show you, this is what we do and here's why we do it. And I think that in addition to just going out and looking at a farm, that people need to know the questions they're asking and the answers that are appropriate and the answers that will be good for them, good for the animals, good for the farmers, good for the community. So there needs to be, beyond just a visit, there needs to be a dialogue, and I'll do everything I can to facilitate that.
Oh, I love that. You're making me even more excited about the conference. I want to know what these questions are. Why do I still have to wait a couple of weeks for the conference? Couldn't it be now? Because, yeah, that's
yeah,
great
come to
talk.
My session.
I'll definitely be there. Yeah, yours is one of the ones that I'm most excited about because there's lots of tracks. And for me, very much the local farm, that's one of the major reasons that I got involved with Weston A. Price Foundation and other organizations too, like Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance, the Savory Institute, all great organizations devoted to local farming.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you for the support of all those.
Oh, yes. Well, and thank you for continuing what you do, because I know that that is an issue of not enough young people going into farming.
Yeah, it's a very difficult time to break into farming. And it's really unfortunate because my read of this, what I consider to be the current generation, the people who are old enough to be starting their careers, let's say, so the 20-somethings, I find that those folks, both at the university and on the farm, are very cause-minded. They recognize that in so many different ways, as the astronauts used to say, we've screwed the pooch. We've messed this thing up, and we need to return to a more reasonable approach to agriculture and to living and to health and to eating, all those sorts of things. And they understand that. The young people understand it in a way that many people of my generation don't. And at the very time that they're recognizing that, they're also facing, in my opinion, insurmountable odds. The obstacles to break into farming, just as an example, the type of farming that we do requires land. Now, there is farming that can be done that doesn't require very much land. If you're raising produce, you can do that very intensively on a small plot of land and make a living at it. But we're raising proteins, and we're converting cellulose into high-quality protein, and that takes some grasslands. And the idea that we would go to a 20-something, especially 20-something that's coming out of school right now with debt, and we say, oh, by the way, we're expecting you to go into debt, let's say $1 million to buy a decent parcel of land. And we're expecting you on that $1 million to make a living by yourself and to adopt a lifestyle that you will be able to afford any help. So you'll have to do everything yourself. You'll work this farm 24/7. It will basically become your prison. It'll be a prison that you'll enjoy being locked in some of the time, but some of the time you won't. And there'll come a time when you need a break from that prison, but you can't take that break because you're saddled with all this debt that you've got to take on and you're not part of a team. I look at all that and just, I really feel for young people trying to get into farming. I couldn't, in all honesty, recommend that approach to any young person right now. It doesn't look like it's in the cards. So we've got a very different model. We have 1,100 acres that we currently farm, which is a small farm by Western standards, a large farm by Tennessee standards. And we've divided the farm operation up into different enterprises. So we're looking for young people who want to manage a farm enterprise. We provide all the capital, all the infrastructure, all the back office support, all the marketing, all the branding, the legal accounting, pay the taxes, pay the insurance, all that. And we split the gross margin. They take half the gross margin to pay themselves a living. We take the other half to cover all the fixed costs, the overhead costs, the corporate costs. And they don't ever have to go in debt a dime. They don't ever risk a dime. They don't have to come up with any money. They just have to be smart and willing to work hard. If they do that, we're giving young people an opportunity to get into farming. And we think that that's a viable solution. It's proving to work pretty well. But if the other models, for a young person to do what my grandfather did, I don't think it's possible. The prices were good enough then, and yet the cost of buying land was low enough then, that he could pay off his farm in 5 years. Today, a young person buying that same farm would never, ever pay it off. The money they could expect to make off that 132-acre farm that he bought wouldn't service the debt. They would be going further in the hole every single year. And so young people are not buying farms, and it makes perfect sense that they wouldn't be, at least in Tennessee. There's just too many competing uses for that land, and we don't have any sort of planning that would regulate the use of it. So you have to bid against anyone. Somebody wants to put in a subdivision, you have to compete with them. Somebody wants to put in a shopping mall, you compete with them. And those folks can make money on that land and in a way that a farmer can't. So it's untenable right now what the opportunities that are facing most young people at the very time that so many of them see the opportunity, they're not able to afford it.
Sadly, I imagine that's probably a problem in a number of other states and regions. I know in California, I have seen some new farms. I see them at the farmer's market, and I know that they're not without their troubles too, that it doesn't go so easily. So I love your model of the venture capital. So you're doing this for the community that you're in. Do you see this as the future model of local farms in different communities?
Yes, I do. It's not real widespread, but I need to be real forthright and say, I didn't invent this model. We actually stole this model from Seven Sons, which is a farm in Roanoke, Illinois, just north of Indianapolis. There was a family, I may get some of the details wrong on this, but a husband and wife raised seven sons on 504 acres of land. All the boys wanted to go into farming. And so the parents said, we'll give you each an enterprise and you can make your living in that enterprise, but you can't compete with each other. And they developed the brand, Seven Sons brand, and it was direct to consumers. And the family's done well with that model. We're simply trying to do what Seven Sons does with their sons and daughters. We're trying to do it with the sons and daughters of other people. So it's a model that can be made to work. Whether or not it's going to become the new normal, I think it's a bit early to say that. But when you think about it, this is in some ways a return to what agriculture was, with a few important differences. Remember, the first four generations of farmers in my family in Tennessee, they were all farming on other people's land. They couldn't afford to get into it themselves. So in some ways, we're returning that. We're just not returning to the tenant farmer or sharecropper model. I think we have a better model than that. But this notion that there were always people that were interested in farming but couldn't afford to buy farmland, that problem's been around for a long time.
And so obviously it's an issue of being able to buy a small farm, but then we're also losing a lot of the ones that we have. We've touched upon a little. What are the major problems that you see occur from losing local farms?
The root cause of all of this has been the industrialization of agriculture. As soon as you turned it into basically a manufacturing business, then you get these huge economies of scale, and all the focus is on cost, providing something that you can sell as food at the lowest possible cost. And when that happened, and it started around the time of World War II, we started applying a lot of industrial policies to agriculture at that point, a lot of industrial practices. And when that happened, we really saw just a huge drop in the number of small farms, because if there are such cost savings to be had, if you approach this thing as an industry, especially if you approach it as an industry that has a very different set of standards for quality. The same thing has happened in other types of agriculture. Let's take vineyards, for example. There are some huge vineyards that are focused on low-cost production of a so-so wine, and that's where a lot of U.S. agriculture is today. They're huge productions producing so-so products. Classic example that I use all the time is you can go into a big box store today and buy a fully prepared, ready to take home and eat rotisserie chicken for $4.50. Now, that chicken is not going to be raised in a way that either you nor I would approve of. It's going to have had a terrible existence. The people who work on those farms have a terrible existence. Those farms are not good for the community and they're not good for the environment. I find very little to say good about those sorts of farms. I apologize to my friends that operate those kinds of farms, but we just have a difference of opinion on what it means to be a good farm. To give you a counterexample, on our local farm, we have a group of chicks ready to move out of the brooder. The broilers are going to go out on pasture this week. We have $4.50 tied up in those chicks already, and they're only now getting ready to come out of the brooder. I can't touch the cost that these big factory farms have. They can't touch my quality of the product, my quality of the lifestyle of the farmers that raise it, the humanitarian approach we take to raising our livestock, the positive impact we're having on the environment. They can't touch any of that. I'm better than they are on all of those things. I don't think it's even a close contest, nor is it a close contest that they're a whole lot cheaper than I am. So as long as we have consumers that buy the cheapest proteins, the cheapest food they can buy, and not realize that there's a huge difference between a $2 bottle of wine and a $50 bottle of wine, just like there's a huge difference between a $4.50 chicken and a $45 chicken, as long as consumers don't make a distinction, family farms will continue to disappear. But as long as we've got folks like those at the Weston A. Price Foundation who understand the difference and value the difference, then there's a place for these farms. Here's the bottom line. Local farms can exist producing commodity products. A commodity is what comes out of an industry. We have to sell a very specialized, value-added and valued product, and we need to sell that directly to the consumer. When farmers in the United States are producing commodities that are sold through traditional industrial channels, they get about 7.8 cents of every food dollar spent in the United States. You can't live on 7.8 cents out of every dollar. All the rest of that money is going out to the middleman in between. Local farms need to be serving local customers, and they need to be going direct to customers. If they do, then they have access to that entire food dollar, not just the 7.8 cents. That's the key to local farms surviving, is having customers that want to buy from those local farms and farmers that sell directly to those customers that value what they're doing. If we don't do that, if you just treat it like a commodity product, you will go out of business. This isn't up for debate. University of Tennessee does a study every single year. They do a cattle budget, and they look at the amount of money supposedly to be made. It's actually the amount of money to be lost if you're, let's say, in the cow-calf business. And in an exceptionally good year, you might break even. But most years, you can expect to lose money. You can expect to lose money if you are producing a commodity product that's sold into commodity channels and distributed in the way that most of our food is distributed. It's simply not a sustainable model.
You talked a lot now about the problems occurring from losing local farms. On the flip side, what are the reasons you'd recommend for people to eat locally?
Number one reason is if they care about what it is they're eating. And when you think about it, food is the drug we take every single day. And if you care about what you're putting in your body every single day, you need to be paying attention to where that food comes from. And you cannot trust labeling. The labeling is just too obscure and too murky. For example, many folks at the Wise Traditions Conference will know that technically, you can have chickens that are free range if there's a door left open that will allow those chickens to go outside. Now, they're going to be Cornish crosses. They're going to be designed for one purpose, to sit on the rear end and eat feed and drink water and get fat in 60 days so that they can be killed for food. And they're never going to go outside. But if you read the label, free range. The only way to know what you're actually getting is to buy local and go see for yourself and ask those questions. If you visit a farm that says that they're feeding you pastured poultry and you go there and you don't see any birds on pasture, ask a question about it. If you care about what you're eating, you need to eat local. But there are other reasons as well. As I've said before, the local farms, we believe that there are four big differences. The quality of the food, just how clean it is, and how nutritionally dense it is. In my opinion, local farms are going to do a better job than the industrial farms on that. The other is how the animals were treated. We have an external certification program on our farm. We are regularly inspected to make sure that we are treating our animals humanely, just so that we can assure somebody. It's not my opinion. It's the opinion of the experts. We are treating our animals humanely. But again, you can go see that for yourself. And look at how the animals are being kept and how they're being managed. That's important. The quality of life for the farmers. Farming is one of the toughest businesses anywhere. Farming has one of the highest suicide rates of any industry right now. Farming treated as an industry, the moment you turn farming into a manufacturing process, it becomes a pretty miserable existence for the people who have to do that work. And the last one is the impact it's having on the environment. We're staunch supporters of regenerative agriculture. One of our eight values that guides our farm is we want to be good ancestors. We know that our ancestors left the farm better than they found it. We want to do the same thing for future generations, and that influences every decision we make. In fact, we were just recognized this year with the Governor's Award in Environmental Stewardship in Tennessee because of our work on regenerative agriculture. It is a very strongly held commitment of ours, and I don't see that same commitment held by many other industrial farms. I think the best place to get that is going to be your local farm. So that's four reasons to support local farms, and we get people that identify with one of those more than the others, but those four, if folks are going to buy from us, it's going to be because of one of those four reasons or some combination of the four. And that suits us fine because that's just the kind of customer we want to serve.
It goes back to what we were talking earlier about the importance of visiting the farms. And I like that you get into the different labels and certifications. You said you have an external certification on your farm. Which is that?
We're GAP 4 certified. Here's a little bit of a background on that for some of your listeners that may not understand this. When you are producing at a small scale biological product like animals, an organic product, you need some flexibility because you don't control Mother Nature. And so some years you'll have more, some years you'll have less. So every single product has to have a plan B. So that if you overproduce, you've got a use for those animals that you've overproduced. For ours, just take beef, for example. When we overproduce beef, we sell them to an aggregator. Hickory Nut Gap is a brand over in the Asheville, North Carolina area. They do a superb job of working with farmers across, I think they are now working from farmers all the way from West Virginia down to Florida. And the small farmers that are committed to raising animals correctly, but don't want to be involved in the marketing of those animals, they sell through Hickory Nut Gap. Well, that's where we sell our excess animals. And a lot of those animals are going to go to distribution outlets like Whole Foods that have very strong stances on animal welfare. So the Global Animal Project, the GAP project, has different levels of certification. We're GAP 4 certified so that we can sell basically into any of those retail outlets through Hickory Nut Gap. They can sell to any of those retail outlets. We don't service them directly and know that there's external certification that the animals have been treated humanely.
Yes, I think a lot of people have shopped at Whole Foods. They may know of the GAP program. They've certainly done a great job raising awareness of it. Of course, there are many other types of certifications, both government and private organizations from USDA Organic, Certified Humane, the American Grass-Fed Association, Certified Grass-Fed, and now we're seeing regenerative certifications. There's a few different ones of those. What are your thoughts on these different certification programs?
I have very mixed opinions about them. I think they're very well-intentioned, and philosophically, I support virtually everyone that you mentioned. We've looked at several. For example, we're one of the baselines farms for the Savory Institute as they're trying to understand what you could reasonably expect to see in the way of regenerative agriculture in different biospheres, different regions. We are the base farm for one of those regions, and we're participating and cooperating with Savory in that regard. We're also very aware and close to the folks in the Grass-Fed Alliance and looking at their certification. All of those add cost, and our costs are already very high because we're not a mass producer of so quality. We're a boutique producer of extremely high quality, and so our costs are going to be higher. Adding additional costs cannot be done lightly. And right now, I think there's already a lot of confusion on the part of customers on what labeling means and what it doesn't mean. So we don't want to put half a dozen different stickers on our labels. We think that that would be confusing and wouldn't be warranted in terms of what customers would get. We feel much more comfortable with, we state our protocols. Here's what we do. And we adhere to those protocols very strictly, but we want more of a one-on-one understanding between us and our consumers of what we do and why we do it. And that's been our approach. There are differences of opinion on this, and we wrestle with it every single year. We struggle to figure out, okay, what certification do we need and what would be warranted? Any of the certifications that we've ever pursued, we never had any trouble qualifying for it because they said, well, you're already doing what we say. Yeah, that's kind of the point. But just going to the added expense and the labeling of adding that certification, for the most part, we've chosen not to do that.
That's a very good point you bring up about the added expense. And I can understand why a lot of small local farms don't want to do the certifications. I think also the confusion is a good point to bring up. And I think a lot of the labels, maybe all of them, they may have some confusion. I certainly know organic. I think now it's almost very out there of the confusion you can get because organic does allow for some types of pesticides to be sprayed, the organic ones. On the other hand, I do still support it. I think it's hard to argue the awareness it has brought to it. So now we're seeing it with the new ones. And there's many different types of regenerative certifications, and they all do it a little differently. Do you think there's some confusion as to what regenerative is?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Working at the university and at the farm, it was only a couple of years ago that I had a dean of an agriculture college called me up and said, hey, I'm hearing a lot of this regenerative stuff. What is regenerative? So yeah, there's confusion at all levels of what regenerative means. For us, it means that's what we're talking about in that value of ours. It says we want to be good ancestors. We want to leave the land better off than we found it. And so we're all about soil health. And we take a very simple approach to defining regenerative. We will be regenerative if we are regenerating the carrying capacity of what this land once offered. And that's what we're trying to regenerate. It's the healthiness in the soils will allow it to support life in abundance in a way that has largely been lost. As we've got some land that we bought that had been traditionally farmed. And for the first 3 years that we owned it, we found it almost impossible to get anything to grow on it. The land had been sprayed, let's say, a half a dozen times a year with either a pesticide, an herbicide, or a fungicide. It had been artificially fertilized, and there was no soil on it. It was just dirt. It was just a medium to hold chemicals that were going to be delivered to plants, and it had no life in it whatsoever. And so we know that we have been regenerative and that we could now go to those very same acres that we couldn't get anything to grow on for 3 years, and now there's just an abundance of life, all in the soil and the diversity of the plants there. And in its carrying capacity, it's hugely different. And we get much more carrying capacity now on that same land with no added inputs. We're not fertilizing anymore. And we get more output than they did when they were fertilized. It's a bizarre thing to look at, but that's what regenerative is all about.
I would absolutely 100% agree with you that there's a lot of confusion as to what regenerative means. Because I know that when I attend the big show every year, the Natural Products Expo West, every year I see more and more products with a regenerative label, a certification, and there's very different ones. I very much subscribe to how Savory Institute looks at regenerative, and a big thing with them is it has to have some use of livestock in order to be regenerative, which I know certainly that applies to your farm as it's all animals, but some of these ones where they're plant products, I question how they're regenerative if they don't have any use of animals with them.
Yeah, so let's get technical just for a moment with your listeners, the place they don't want to go. But we're surrounded by row croppers. We don't do any row cropping ourselves. By row cropping, plants, corn and soybeans for the most part, planted in rows, that's a row crop. Those two crops are heavily genetically modified for the most part, and they're designed to be tolerant of the pesticides and herbicides and fungicides that are going to be sprayed on those crops over and over again. So it kills everything else, but it doesn't kill those crops. And that's what genetically modified is all about. So on this land that we're surrounded by, this row crop, we approached one of the more progressive farmers in the row cropping community and said, let's do an experiment. Let's run cattle on the cover crops that you're going to plant. So there's the main crop that is grown and harvested in the summer, in the growing season. And then there's a cover crop that's put on that land when the main crop comes off and grows on it throughout the winter to get the advantage of having a growing plant on that soil and more carbon capture and pumping those carbons in the ground. And we said, let's see if we can get an improvement instead of just letting that cover crop grow there and then be plowed under at the end of the year. We will have that cover crop consumed by livestock, turned into manure, and then put back on the land in that way. And it was clear that there is an advantage to integration of animals. We were initially concerned about compaction. Turned out not to be an issue if we managed it right, if we grazed right in the way that smart grazers are supposed to do. We didn't have a problem with compaction, but we did get more soil health and more soil life by the integration of animals. So yes, we are absolutely big believers in adding. For years, there were four main principles of soil health, and adding animals, integrating those into it, I think is a very important addition.
Yes. Chris Kirsten, he's the co-CEO of Land to Market, which was spun off from the Savory Institute. He was on this program about a year ago, and he explained that while most of their products are livestock products, animals, they will do products for crops, but it's important that they use animals in it in order to be part of their program. And the one he mentioned that they do have now, it's interesting that you mentioned wine, because there's the Cargo Road Winery in Australia where they are Land to Market certified.
Interesting. I'd heard about them. I'll go look them up and study them. Yeah, it's hard for me to imagine a healthy, improving environment that doesn't include animals. Think about it. If you looked out over a landscape and it didn't have animals engaged in it, involved in it, central to it, would you imagine that landscape you're looking at would be a healthy one or an unhealthy one? If it's healthy, the animals are going to be there. And if the animals are going to be there, it's going to help it to be healthy. It's just the way that nature evolved and the system works best. So, yeah, I think animals need to be there. In fact, right now, our big push for years in Tennessee, we farmed in a way that we fenced our livestock out of the woods. We're now in the process of reversing all that, and we're moving our animals into the woods, and we're moving trees into our pastures. So we've got a big research project now and try to move from having pasture land, which is basically just all grass, to having savannas, which would be trees interspersed with grasslands. And there's lots of reasons to believe that that will be much more sustainable and regenerative than the monocultures. This is pasture, that's woodland. They all need to be integrated and first, and there need to be animals grazing across both of those.
Yes, as we've talked about the issue of labels and the confusion they give, another thing we're hearing is the idea of eating local. I know certainly that's a term we hear a lot of. And my question for you would be, do you think that there is a legitimate movement to eat local, or is it more just a catchphrase and more needs to be done to actually get people to do this?
I think there is a very strong movement to do this. In Tennessee, at the very time that Tennessee is losing much of its farmland, we're also seeing, not coincidentally, a huge influx of people who are moving to Tennessee because they want a connection to a local community and to local food. So this is a very strong ethos here with our community. I would say that most of our growth that we're seeing for our products are coming from folks who have been transplanted to Tennessee who really value eating locally. And it's absolutely a strong movement. Now, could there be more? Sure, there could. I'm proud to say that in Tennessee, there's very active programs, as there are in many states across the nation, that facilitates that. So each state would be a little bit different. But if you were in Tennessee, you could actually go online to a website called Pick Tennessee, and you type in your zip code, and it's going to tell you, here are all the local farms around you that would encourage you to come visit and be their customers. Here are all the farmers markets that you can visit. And so the state has made a tremendous effort to try to make it easy for people to connect with their local farmers. I think that that's widespread. More can be done in that area. More people need to get the message that eating local is an incredibly important part of being a responsible citizen in this globe that we live in. Jane Goodall, in the book that she wrote, she said the number one most important thing that anyone can do in terms of the overall impact it will have on the globe, in terms of the quality of life of people, of animals, of environments, social justice, you name it, any of those issues you want to impact, what's the number one thing that you can do? Eat local. You need to be eating food that's produced where you are. If people didn't understand this before, surely to goodness, the food shortages associated with COVID, we as a nation should be embarrassed. We hit a little speed bump in the road and suddenly our grocery store shelves are empty. Really? We're supposed to be a global superpower and we can't feed our own people? That was just a huge black eye for the whole industrial food model that said it's not working. Treating this as a global manufacturing business in the way that you might manufacture bicycles in Taiwan and ship them around the world makes no sense whatsoever. It needs to be a local network instead of a global supply chain. If your customers in the food market, if they want to understand this, think of it this way. When I say global supply chain, underline the word chain. And what do we know about a chain? A chain is only as strong as its weakest link. So if there's one failure anywhere in that supply chain, the entire chain falls apart and it doesn't work. Now think about a local food network. Think about a net. When one strand of a net breaks, what happens to the net overall? Not much. You can sure catch fish with a net that has a single strand broken in it, but you can't supply food in a supply chain that has a single link missing. That's how vulnerable our global supply chain is and why it needs to be replaced with local food networks. And the folks at Western A Price are just absolutely central to that. They've understood that for a long time and are real pioneers in making that local food network real.
Yes, and they have introduced us to a number of great farmers in Tennessee, because in fact, their conference last year was where you are in Knoxville, Tennessee. And I know also Tom Naughton, he used to live in LA like me. He directed the documentary Fathead, and he's actually moved now to Tennessee to go into the farming business.
Yeah, we hosted the visits last year after the Lost Traditions Conference and got to know some of the folks from Western A Price. And we're just so excited about them and what they were trying to do that we were delighted this year to get to be speakers at the National Convention. I wish I could stick around for the farm tours that are going to be after the conference, the program. Unfortunately, I have to get back to that day job, back to flashlight farming again.
Yes, and so you talked a little about the animals. You mentioned the chickens you have on your farm. Tell us a little more of all the different animals raised where you are.
Mm-hmm. We have four enterprises right now, beef, pork, lamb, and poultry. In poultry, we do broiler chickens, and we're also experimenting this year with turkeys, and that's gone very well. So it looks like turkeys will be a part of that enterprise. And then also eggs, of course, are a part of that, the poultry enterprise. So that's where we are right now. We are experimenting with additional enterprises all the time, looking at new products that we could launch. Interestingly, right now, one of the ones I'm most excited about is dog food. Just as people have learned that industrial produced food is not good for people, it's also not good for animals, especially animals that were designed to be predators. And so there's a big movement now that many of your listeners will know about to feed real meat to pets. That's a really nice opportunity because we still have parts of animals that we are not able to consume and market that would make perfectly good products for pet food. For example, humans are not interested in consuming tracheas. Dogs love tracheas. So we need those sorts of products to be fully utilized as well, to make full use of those animals. We really respect and revere our animals, and we want to make sure that their death means something. And one of the ways to show that is to make sure that we use every bit of that animal that we possibly can, and pet food would be a way of doing it. So that may be the next enterprise that we own.
I love that. I always joke that I don't own any pets because I can't find the right sustainable food to feed them. And I am seeing that now. I love seeing that with ranchers. I've also seen that with seafood companies now.
Yes.
There's a company, Safe Catch, who now has sustainable food for your pet.
Mm-hmm. We've used sustainable seafood for a long time in our broiler operation. There are chickens you can get out there. People are making a big deal of poultry that is raised vegetarian chickens. Well, chickens were never designed to be vegetarians. Chickens are omnivores. If a chicken catches a mouse, it's going to eat it. Chickens are great mousers. Chickens were designed to eat meat. So then comes the question, okay, how can you sustainably feed meat to chickens safely? Do it? And we use sustainably harvested anchovies and sardines as a protein source for our chickens. We have to be careful to do that, not to flavor the eggs, because eggs are really susceptible to that. But to do right by your birds, you've got to be feeding them some animal protein, and that's the solution we have. So I think there are better ways of farming the sea, and I think that's another place where consumers need to be very careful and wise. The reason it's called Wise Traditions is that wisdom needs to be involved here, and we need to be wise about how we're pulling resources and products out of the sea as well.
Yes, as we talk about confusion among consumers, when you see those vegetarian fed labels on the egg cartons or on the chicken, it's not true. People want to hear that, but they have such this disconnect. I even once saw actually a chicken in a store that said 100% grass-fed chicken.
That chicken really suffered if that ever actually happened. My favorite so far is sun-dried wood. Sun-dried firewood. I thought that was a clever marketing gimmick.
And so you've given a description of the different livestock that you offer on the farm. Where do you sell the produce? Where can people find these wonderful products?
Our main distribution outlet is online. So we go direct to consumers through our website. Lickskillet.farm is the website. We currently ship into 7 states. It's Tennessee and the states immediately surrounding it. Over the next 3 years, we have a plan to service basically everything east of the Mississippi. But that depends on continued expansion of direct-to-door delivery. A lot of consumers may not be aware of this, but there is a huge change underway in the retail business, and that's direct-to-door delivery. You think about it this way. There will be very few days of the year that we don't have a UPS or a FedEx truck within a quarter of a mile, let's say, of our farm. And many of your listeners will be the same way. There's just always local service. Well, if that truck is already coming to your neighborhood, one of the greenest and most cost-effective ways that you can shop today is to have your products delivered directly to you. The truck was already there. It's not like you drove into town to buy product. No, there was already a truck, and not putting that product on the truck that was already coming to you is a missed opportunity. It essentially costs the trucking companies nothing to add one more product to be delivered on that route. As that gets to be more and more true, it will be more and more practical and more advisable for us to be making home deliveries. And our model is that in the future, we will be 100% delivered to your door. There's already a truck coming. Why don't you let us deliver it to your door, and we'll all be better off? So that's where we're heading, is buy online, we'll ship it to your door.
I'd love to learn more about that. You certainly give us a lot to think about in terms of the future of farming and the future in a good way, how it can be more sustainable and a better model than what we're currently seeing. We're just about out of time. You gave the address for the farm. If you could please give the website address once again, as well as if you want to give the address for your college where you teach at, and let the listeners know where they can learn more about both you as a professor and a farmer.
Sure. I teach at the University of Tennessee, the Haslam College of Business, and then our family's farm is lickskillet.farm. You can also find us on Facebook. It's Lickskillet Farm TN for Tennessee. And anybody who wants to pull me aside for a conversation at the Wise Traditions, I would love to talk about this. I'm on a one-man mission to save farmland. And so anyone who's interested in this topic, please let's strike up a conversation and see what we can do together.
I know that we'll be having some more conversations at the conference. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thanks for giving this topic time. It's an important topic, and I'm glad to see your interest in it. That's encouraging.
Me too. Yes, I'm very glad that we took time to discuss this, and I can't wait to hear your presentation. I know I'm going to learn a lot.
I'll see you there.
All right. That's all for this episode of The Appropriate Omnivore. New episodes of the show are released every Wednesday. Follow me on social media for more information on the next episode. And to make sure you never miss any of my podcasts, subscribe to The Appropriate Omnivore on your favorite podcast site or app. You can also listen to all my podcasts on my website, appropriateomnivore.com. There you can find recipes from the guests I interview, plus all of my articles covering lifestyles in the world of real food. Until next time, my pantry is officially closed.